Today's episode is brought to you by USTA New England. Join USTA New England in their summer campaign to get more players out on the court for their hashtag #IAmATennisPlayer initiative. Visit www.playtennisnewengland.com for more information or listen out for an overview midway through the show today. Now turn up the volume because it's time for another fantastic WTA superstar. Hey, fantastic fans, John here. This is episode 25, and it's a pretty big deal for me, and I'm so happy and so proud that I've been able to get this far with so many amazing players whose stories I've been able to tell. So I wanted to say a heartfelt thank you for everyone listening. I honestly couldn't do this without all of your support. If you've donated to the show, or you've left a comment on Instagram or Twitter, or if you've written a review on Apple Podcasts, I just can't thank you enough. I'm so excited for this episode with Marion Bartoli. I've been a huge fan for as long as I can remember. She was so cool to spend an hour plus with me. I will say, she was in transit for most of the show, at least for the first half of the show, so the audio is not as pristine as I typically shoot for, but I promise the content is there. I mean, come on, it's Marion Bartoli. But I just wanted to say thanks again. With all your support, it would be a dream to make it to another 25 episodes. You guys are fantastic.
Please take your seats quickly, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.
I mean, they always have a big mouth. They always talk a lot. So it happened before, it's going to happen again.
This week's fan guest is an opponent turned good friend that I met almost 15 years ago while playing in a tennis tournament in Los Angeles, California. I distinctly remember him telling me in our very first conversation that today's guest was his very favorite player. And we even made a trip to the Miami Open and watched her play and win, by the way. So, of course, I had to invite him to join the fun today. As a huge WTA super fan living in Austin, Texas, he's followed her career from the very beginning and lists her 2009 upset of then world number one, Jelena Jankovic, at the Australian Open as one of his very favorite fan moments outside of Wimbledon. Please welcome Jeremiah Merkel. Jeremiah, happy to Zoom see you.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
Jeremiah, do you remember that 2010 Miami Open match we watched?
Absolutely. Yeah, like yesterday. I don't know, Marion may remember as well. We were in the corner cheering her on, and there was two French ladies behind us. We're like, go Marion, and they're like, it's Marion. And we're like, go Marion. It was against Gisela Dulko. Close first set, once Marion got the momentum, it was like steamroll.
It was great. I stuck around to watch her beat Kuznetsova in the next round. It was a great tournament. We have so much to talk about today, so let's bring her out. On July 6, 2013, the tennis world watched as our very special guest's dream came true, as she entered the history books by winning the 2013 Wimbledon title. That may have been the end of her fairy tale playing career, but hearing the beginning of this tennis tale will prove a deeper appreciation for its abrupt end. We'd first hear her name after winning the 2001 Junior US Open title, but she topped that the very next year at the 2002 US Open when she baffled legend Arantxa Sánchez Vicario in the first round with her unique two hands off both sides approach to the game. That win would be the first of 14 players she would defeat throughout her career that would eventually become number one. In 2006, our French powerhouse would add the first of 8 career singles titles to her mantle, but it would be in 2007 where she would light up the tennis world on the historic lawns of the All England Club to advance to her first Grand Slam final by upsetting then world number one, Justine Henin, along the way. In 2011, she'd proved that her game would also translate to the terre battue of Roland Garros as she thrilled the home Parisian crowd with a deep run to the 2011 French Open semifinals. She'd add quarterfinal finishes at both the Australian and the US Open to solidify her name as one of the most consistent players from the last decade. After a shock retirement announcement just a few weeks after her dream run to the 2013 Wimbledon title, she'd continue to stay close to the sport, playing Legends doubles events, becoming one of the sought-after tennis commentators around the world, and a WTA supercoach to French Open champion Yelena Ostapenko. Today, we can add jewelry designer, fashion student, wife, and now new mother to her growing list of accomplishments, And I'm beyond thrilled that she's here to reminisce and talk about her inspiring tennis journey. Please welcome the fantastic Marion Bartoli. Marion, hello.
Hi, guys. How are you? I'm so excited about this time.
We're so honored you're here today. I'm wearing my Wimbledon white in your honors. It's going to be incredible today. We have so much to talk about. First, Marion, congratulations, I want to say, on baby Camellia.
Yeah, she has been really a joy. It has been a fun ride. She's almost 5 months now. And every day just to see her growing and discovering the world has been really absolutely life-changing. But we have loved every single moment with my husband. It has been an incredible journey so far.
It's so amazing. You're Mommy Marion now. I mean, you can add that to your list of many jobs.
She's so cute.
How is she? Is she sleeping through the nights? Is she good right now? 5 months. Are you getting some sleep?
Yeah, I'm starting to get some sleep. She was a little bit difficult at the beginning, but of course it's normal. But what was difficult for me is I didn't really stop working. So I had a tough night for sleep. And then during the day, I had to still go through my work as normal. But that was a bit challenging. But right now she's almost going through her nights every single night. And, you know, she's just so cute when you hear her starting to wake up and you go to her crib. She's smiling at you right away, and that's just, you know, making my day every single morning. So
if I could bottle how happy you sound, Marion, I bet you could sell it for a fortune right now. You sound so happy. We're so glad.
Thank you.
We have a lot to cover today between your iconic career, fan questions, and all the many hats you've worn since retirement. So I think we should jump right into today's show. But before we peel back all the layers from Marion's amazing career, I'd like to start the pod the exact same way Marion started as she served 5-4 in the second set of the 2013 Wimbledon final. And that's
15 love
with an ace, by the way. It's a super simple game. I'm going to throw 15 questions at you, Marion, and you just respond as quickly as you can with the first thing that pops into your Bartoli brain. All right. Marion, number one, name the first professional tennis match you remember watching live or on television.
Final of Roland Garros between Steffi Graf and Monica Seles in 1992.
What an iconic match. The quality of that match. Good way to start today. All right, number two, Marion, as I mentioned, is a brand new mom to baby Camellia. But we wondered, what was a gift that a player from the tour gave your new baby girl?
Oh, I had so many, but two actually. I can't really split them. One from Dominika Sibulkova. She got me a beautiful dress from Tartine and Chocolat, which is a beautiful baby brand. And another one from actually Yelena Ostapenko, who got me a gift from her country, which is a small spoon and a small bowl that you have to give to your baby when she's starting to eat a normal meal and that is supposed to wish her luck in life. That was two very special gifts.
We saw that on your Instagram. Really well done. Good job, Yelena. Well done. That was a great one. All right, number three, your father, Dr. Walter, was such an important part to the mechanics of your game and style. And really was a big part of the WTA for over a decade. So I wondered, what's one piece of tennis advice from him that you still use in your coaching today?
Actually, a lot of them. But the main one would be to use the first step to go into the ball and do not wait for it. This is really something that my dad has been learning me since my childhood, is to go inside the court and go to the ball rather than waiting for it. And that's really still the advice I'm giving to Yelena when she's playing. You know, she has a very similar style to mine. And every time she is sometimes, you know, sticking too much for me behind the baseline and she should be going into the court. I remember exactly my father telling me the same when I was too far behind the baseline and not really going inside the court enough. So that's really something I'm still giving as an advice to my players.
I'm absorbing that today. So thank you for that. A lot of fans want to know how Papa Walter is. You know, we used to see him at tournaments all the time. How is he?
He's loving his retirement. He's actually still coaching some kids in the village in Corsica when they have now their retiring home with my mom. So he's still passionate by tennis, obviously. And now he plays almost professional chess level. So he has a national ranking in France in chess, and that's his second passion. But he's so in love with Camellia. Every time he's telling me, when are you coming back to Corsica? I'm missing her. I want to see her. So I think he's gonna play really the granddaddy sticking to his granddaughter.
He's gonna be grandpapa.
Yes.
I bet he can't wait to put a tennis racket in hand. I love it. I absolutely love it. Number four, Marion, your daughter is gonna grow up to know that her mother is a Wimbledon champion. But I wondered, if you had to show her one match from your long career that wasn't a Wimbledon match, which match would you choose?
Let me think about it. Actually, a 2012 Miami match against Vika in the quarterfinal. Yeah,
was so
that
good.
Was an incredible match.
I mean, you broke her streak. We're going to talk about it a little bit. It was a fantastic match. How would you feel if Camelia started playing tennis? Are we good
I
with that?
I would love if she can play to start tennis. My husband is obsessed with her starting to play tennis. But as I say to him, maybe she would just hate tennis. She doesn't want to play. So we have to go with the flow and see how it goes. And obviously, I would not force anything. But if she wants to become professional, then I would help her to do that. But you know, it's such a long road, and maybe she would say I was a very crap tennis player and she doesn't want to play at all.
You know, she always has soccer too. Dad's a great soccer player. So, I mean, that also could work.
Soccer is rubbish. No, actually, my husband prefers tennis to soccer. He's actually even watching more tennis matches than soccer matches, believe it or not.
There are so many new tennis moms out there, Marianne. We had Lucy Safarova on the show this week, and baby Leia, she's trying to recruit Olympia Ohanian to be her doubles partner on the tour in the future. So we have to get on Camelia playing early.
Such a team already. Jesus.
We have to start very soon.
I can see that.
Number five, Marianne, speaking of doubles, you may have been known for your singles game, but you were quite the doubles player as well. You'd get to 15 in the world and win 3 career doubles titles. Can you share a fun doubles memory from your career?
I had a lot, actually, but one of the great one was when I played with Maria Sharapova, the beginning of both of our careers, because we played the junior together. We started to play on the WTA Tour together, and we got a wild card, the Australian Open, and we won our first round match against 2 very accomplished doubles players, and we were so young. I think she was 15 or 16, and that was a lot of fun, actually, to play with her.
Sharapova played maybe 15 doubles tournaments her entire career. So we know she must have liked you, that you got her on the doubles court. That must
Well, her
great.
Dad was every time, her dad and the agent, Max, was just saying, Marianne, you cover the return and Maria is taking care of the rest. I think he liked the way I returned the serve. And it was just a lot of fun. We used to practice together many times. And I think we both had almost, you know, the same mental attitude when we were on the court. And it was a good match.
Oh, so good. You also got to the 2003 US Open semifinals with Miriam Casanova. You played Navratilova Kuznetsova in that match. That must have been so fun.
That was so fun. We such had a great run that year with Miriam because we played a lot of very good players, especially, I think, if I remember well, we beat Paola Suarez and another player, I think, from Spain. And
Virginia Rolano Pascual,
exactly. And they were high seeds. And we lost at the end to Zveta and Martina, and they were just too good for us. But I really liked my time playing doubles. I always loved it when I was playing the juniors. You know, I think it was fun to play for your country. You play the sort of mini Fed Cup, and you play with your teammate, and you win in doubles. So that was a lot of fun. But unfortunately, after moving on into the singles, when I started to make my first Grand Slam final in singles, it was very difficult for me to play both and keep up with the training that was necessary for me to be in the top 10 in singles. So that's why I had to stop the doubles. But the beginning of my career was a lot of fun in doubles.
You know, the whole evolution of tennis is that you're still playing doubles today, because number 6, we're going to stick with doubles for a minute. You've played some amazing Legends doubles matches, teaming with the legend herself, Martina Navratilova, and Iva Maioli. If you could team up with any other retired player for your next WTA Legends event, who would you team up with?
Monica Seles, without a doubt.
Yes.
Oh my gosh, that would be a dream.
Could you imagine?
That would be a dream.
The tennis world would stop, Marianne. Like, we would
everyone would.
We have to make this happen. I don't know how it's going to happen, but we have to.
I wish. But you know, the funniest thing is Monica now is such a close friend. And when I start my jewelry line, she really liked my design and she requests for a necklace. And she did a lot of interviews wearing my necklace, and she was like every time taking picture of herself and sending them to me and saying, I'm so proud to wear your necklace. And I was like, you have no idea how much you've been my hero my whole life. And I can't believe now you're wearing something of me, you know, which is incredible. I had posters of her all over my bedroom growing up. She's been my tennis icon and idol throughout my entire tennis time with Pete Sampras. So for me to just meet her and get to talk to her and spend a bit of time with her, which is extraordinary.
Well, that's how a lot of people feel about you too, Marianne. You've been an icon in the tennis world for a long time. So thanks for joining again today. Number 7 is not a question, Marianne, but it's more of a message. I received maybe 100+ messages after I announced that you'd be coming on the show today from your fans. Each message was so sweet and a majority of them simply just wanted to say, please tell Marion how much we love her and how she was like theater to watch on a tennis court. So your fans really did show up for you, Marion, throughout your career.
Oh, that's so nice of them. Thank you. It means a lot.
A lot of your fans felt very protective over you, and they felt like the media didn't really give you all the credit you deserve when you were playing. Did you ever feel like the tennis media was hard on you during your career?
I wouldn't say they were really hard on me, but I would say they didn't really understand my game and my style. And I think they always look at the spectrum of, you know, my father coaching me, and therefore it was just special. And especially in France, you know, they don't really like something unique and special. They pretty much like, you know, something that is regular and doesn't go out of the box. I think in the US, the press was getting a lot more interesting about the dynamic between my father and myself, just because they had a lot more example of Richard coaching Serena and Venus. And it was just not that unique for them. But I would say when I won Wimbledon, everyone was like, okay, now finally we get it. But then I retired, so I didn't really use that moment, you know, sort of getting the press behind me and getting them to change their mind. But I never played for the press. I never played for the media. I just played for myself and for the love of the game. And just when I was entering the court, seeing the fans, you know, cheering me on supporting me on or whatever, that was what was important to me. And of course, trying my best on the court, but not really what the media was writing about what I was doing.
It makes total sense. We'll talk about, obviously, your love affair with tennis and the media in a little bit, but thanks for clarifying that. Number eight. All right. These questions are always fun for me. Aside from your 2011 Wimbledon final, you get one loss, singles or doubles, from your career to turn into a win dead. Which do you pick, Marion?
Beside the 2007 Wimbledon final. Oh, yes, I know. The Fed Cup doubles I lost with Emilie Loi when we lost to Russia, and we lost to Vera Zvonareva and Anastasia Miskina. We lost in a decisive doubles to win the Fed Cup, and that was very painful.
Wow. I'm shocked. Yeah. Jeremiah, are you shocked that she said that too? I thought for sure you would have said French Open semifinal. That's so interesting. The passion she felt playing in Fed Cup was so great. I love it.
Oh, no, losing a final is horrible. Oh, my God. Losing a semifinal, you still have one match to go. You know, it's not like you're in the final match to win the trophy. But when you're in the final match to win the trophy, you play for your country, and you lose that final match to lose the Fed Cup title. That is just awful. Oh, my God.
Wow.
Terrible.
Number nine, for newer fans of the sport, I wondered, actually, this one's for you, Jeremiah. How would you describe Marion Bartoli's game style to someone that's never seen her play?
I would say technically she was a bit unorthodox. Already she's playing two hands on both sides, which is pretty unique. But I think Marion played with this unbridled energy and passion and this kind of love for the game. She kind of had this heart that is very rare. Like, she just played with such heart. And some players you can tell don't necessarily, like, they're playing because their parents want them to, or... But Marion really played because she loved the game, and that always just kind of came through.
Absolutely. The heart, the passion. That's what we love, Marion Bartoli. Is that a good assessment? Is that a good analysis? You're a coach now. So is that a good?
Yeah, I'm pretty satisfied with that.
I just hope, Marion, that your daughter gets to play both hands on two sides. I really hope that happens. I really, if she's going to start playing, we want to see that. That's what we really want to see. So.
Oh my gosh. Can you imagine?
Number 10. I really want fans to get to know the real Marion Bartoli today. So I'd love to talk about your creative side over the years. You've had a successful jewelry line, a Fila collection worn by Yelena Yankovic. You went to fashion school. You water paint. Your skills are plentiful, my friend. So I wondered, what is the current Marion Bartoli creative outlet and project?
Well, there is a lot, but the Fila collection is an ongoing thing. So I still design for them, which I love and adore, because I'm doing the Grand Slam collection. So they're the one, obviously, that are the most shown on the court. And we have such a great group of players, with, of course, Ashley Barty being the number one in the world. So for me, it's just so cool and exciting to do that. And then I still use it because I'm going to launch pretty soon a line of diet products. As you might know, I had some pretty impactful health issue back 3-4 years ago, and I had to recover from them, and I discovered really what was good for me and not good for me in terms of my eating habits and what I should eat, which is not something, of course, you're watching out what you're doing during your tennis career, but when things, you know, stopped you don't necessarily watch it again. And I can do, and I can use my creative side of designing the package and choosing the colors and everything. It's just so much fun. So every time I'm talking with my designer and we switch the colors and choose the exact Pantone I want and stuff, and it's just so much fun. So every time I'm receiving new design, I'm like a kid in a candy store and I just can't wait to see them. And I'm like, this is going to be good or it's not going to be good. I need to see the printout of it because I'm someone very visual. I need to see something in order to give an opinion. So it's just really love to still do that besides everything else I have to do in my life. But I absolutely love to still be creative and work, you know, with amazing brands such as Fila.
I can't wait to see that. Did this diet, did it help you when you were recovering with your health issues? Is this something you subscribe to then? Obviously, I can't wait.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a keto diet.
Oh, great.
And it has massively changed completely my health. I've been regaining so much more energy, so much more mental clarity. My brain is functioning so much better. As you can see, I'm very busy, so I need to have a brain that functions pretty fast. And the keto diet has been my lifesaver. And I feel so much better. I've been able to recover fully from all the health issues I had in the past. And in terms of energy and everything, it just kept changing. So I want most of the world to benefit from it. And I've worked on it since 2 years already. And it's about to launch now worldwide because we had already a launch in Dubai and we're doing great in Dubai where I live, but I really want to make it worldwide now. So we're getting into the long shelf life game, which is completely different from baking fresh as we're doing right now, but it's such a fun ride. And we are very close from releasing everything, but we should be ready before the end of this year.
Well, coming out of COVID, I could definitely use a diet. So I'll be looking for that on the shelves very soon. So I appreciate that. I really do. Perfect timing, Marion Bartoli. As always, perfect timing. Number 11, since we're talking about you off court, can you describe Marion Bartoli off court in just one word?
Very active. I can't say one word. I have to say two words.
I'll say very active. I think you get two. Number 12. Marin, you're famous for having an unorthodox game style that troubled so many opponents over the years. So I wondered, which player did you feel had an odd game style and was a tougher matchup for you over the years?
The toughest matchup for me was Agnieszka Radwanska. That was, oh my God, that was a nightmare. I just couldn't get over the line against her. I was leading some of them. I remember one match I played against her in Stuttgart when Stuttgart was back on the hard courts. And I was hitting 6 love 2 love and still ended up losing the match. And I just couldn't get over the line against her with all her drop shots. And I felt she was reading my game, which was normally my strength. Like none of the players could read really my game. And she was reading it like a book. And every time I was hitting somewhere, she was just there. And I just couldn't find a solution. It was awful to play against her.
It was incredible.
We're such good friends outside of the court, but on the court, oh my God, she gave me so much trouble.
I know. I'm sure you looked at the draw and you're like, not her.
Exactly.
Do you ever think about Marion that Wimbledon final, if Radwanska had won that semifinal?
Yeah, oh my gosh, I thought so many times. But I would have had one chance, I would have been that year, because I think in 2013, at that Wimbledon in particular, I just played so well. And I was so strong physically, and you know, I didn't lose a set, so I really felt like I was on top of my game. But still, just the psychological part of it, of not being able to beat her in the past, would have been an obstacle.
It would have been very difficult for anyone to beat you during that Wimbledon run. Well, number 13, I figured with Wimbledon almost upon us and with a 2013 champion right in front of us, not to mention one of the premier international tennis commentators around the world, Marion, can you go out on a limb and pick two favorites and a dark horse for this year's Wimbledon championships?
Ooh, you. Grass is such a very specific surface, but I will go with Jessica Pegula.
Oh, yeah.
I think she can do really well on grass. I think her game can do a lot of damage on grass because I think she loves to play everything that is quite low and hip high. And I think that will suit her a lot. And the second one, I think Aryna Sabalenka with her power. But she's already top 10. It's not like really a dark horse, but you know, she's never been able to do extremely well in Grand Slam. So for her, it would still be a breakthrough.
I like the picks. Yeah, I'm into it. Well done. Can you believe it's been 2019 since we've had Wimbledon? Insane. Marion, did you have a favorite Wimbledon tradition yourself?
A Wimbledon tradition myself. Well, normally the tradition is my parents are always coming for one match during the championship, just because I get as a singles winner. I have two center court tickets daily throughout the championship, and that is like pure gold because they're so hard to get. It's like almost impossible to get center court tickets. So my dad is always so happy when, you know, he can come to Wimbledon and can see my name like engraved in gold on the champion board. He can just sit on the center court and watch a full day of match. And so that's normally our very small tradition. Obviously now with COVID, everything has changed. But I always bring back a souvenir from Wimbledon. Always, always, always. I'm buying a little something. And, you know, it can be a towel or whatever, T-shirt or just a mug, whatever it is. Yeah. But I'm just, every time I'm going to work at Wimbledon, I always bring back something.
It's nostalgia. It's so I mean, hello.
Yeah.
You're a Wimbledon
it's
champion.
It's so special.
Come on.
So special. Yes. It's so special.
All right, the last one. In 2019, Marion published her autobiography, available on Amazon and everywhere you find your favorite books. In English, it's translated to Reborn. In French, I'm going to massacre the title, so I'll let you say it, please.
Renaître.
Thank you. My French is très tragique. It's terrible. But I did want to commend you, Marion, because since the book is in French, I had to have it translated to English, and it was amazing. There's so much vulnerability and truth in those pages. It made me so happy as a fan and just as a tennis fan to read where you're at today and this great place that you're in compared to what you've gone through. What was the process like putting your career and thoughts down on paper?
Well, actually it happened in two parts. And, you know, the first time I got contacted by the writer who wrote my book, so Gérald Dimaillet, it was just before I went and ran the New York Marathon 2016. So after I went out from the hospital from being way too underweight. So that was a very vulnerable moment for me just because I was still extremely skinny and I was just a lot of doubts in my head basically at that moment. And yeah, I was doubting myself a lot. So for me, those moments when I was saying my story, you can see them, they're a lot darker in the book. And then once we have reconnected a little bit later, you can see a lot more happiness and joy in my comments and in my what I was saying and the story. So you can even sense that throughout the book that, you know, has been two different moments of my life with two different psychological aspects. But they are part of me, they're part of my story, and I wouldn't change it. And it just make me who I am as well today.
It was so beautifully written. What was the response in France and with your family after they read the book?
The response has been incredible. I had so many people writing me on private message on Instagram, just saying that either they were, you know, for women, they were finding themselves into the same trap, and this will give them so many belief and strength that they could actually get out of it and find joy again. Of course, for my fans, saying that, you know, they had no idea how hard my training has been in my childhood and how difficult it was for me to get out from where I grew up towards becoming a Wimbledon champion. And actually, we're in the process right now of taking that book into a movie, which has been also
big announcement. Yeah. Oh, that's big news. Yeah. How fantastic.
Yeah, wow. So that's really a work in process. And we are working with a director from Hollywood to make it a movie with, you know, obviously actress playing my role as I was younger and someone to play my father role and to recreate the court where I practiced when I grew up. And I had to draw the court myself and they put that into a 3D and stuff. So it's just a nice and fun project to go after and just also to have some visual for the fans to really realize, you know, how almost impossible it looked at the beginning, but at the end we made it possible. And that's such a powerful message, I felt.
Oh, so great. I mean, if you wait a couple more years, Camellia can do it. So you just have to wait, just maybe, you know, just a couple more years.
Yeah.
She's got this.
Yeah.
So it's okay.
Yeah, exactly. She has a bodily blood, which is the most important.
Well done. That was our first part of the game today. That was 15 questions with Marion Bartoli. Thank you so much. Jeremiah, this is pretty special, right? Are we having a fun time? This is great today.
Would the movie be in English or French?
English, and probably then translated in French or subtitled in French, but the main one would be in English. The original version would be in English.
Marion, you're going to have a cameo in this movie. You know that, right? We have to see the air swings. We had Sybil Kova in the Lee Na movie. You know, that happened.
Yeah.
Oh, man. So fun. Hey, fantastic fans. I'm sure you're just like me and can't wait to get out and play some tennis this summer. I just read a study released this year. 4 million more people have played tennis last year than the year before. Take that, pandemic. That's a lot of new faces on the courts, and the U.S. Tennis Association of New England wants to celebrate those people in a big way. If you're listening out there and love seeing our fantastic sport grow, join the USTA New England in their I Am a Tennis Player campaign all summer long. The goal is to show that anyone can pick up a racket and hit the courts. When you're out playing this summer, please post your photos on social media and use the hashtag IAmATennisPlayer. Let's see if we can bring some more people into our great sport together. Hey, fantastic fans. I have to tell you about the absolute best purchase I've made this summer. If you're going to spend any time outside, then listen up, because Ape Sportswear is for you. Ape is the highest quality training and athletic shirts around. They've even developed their own fabric made from polyamide yarn technology. It's everything I need. Quick drying and comfortable. And if you're like me and don't like wearing heavy shirts, it's literally the lightest shirt I own. Plus, it offers both 25% and 50% UV protection from the sun. That's 100% a no-brainer. I loved mine so much, I ended up buying a long sleeve for mom and a matching short sleeve for my doubles partner. But that's not even the best part. Ape Sportswear donates $1 for every shirt sold to the Guarapuva Association in Brazil, which is a volunteer organization that helps kids through athletics in their community, which is pretty fantastic. Ape Sportswear is giving fantastic tennis listeners 15% off their first purchase. Just go to their website, apesportswear.com, and enter the promotion code FAN15APE. That's FAN15APE. With Ape Sportswear, you can perform better and make a difference. All right, guys, we're halfway through. We're going to go on to our game today. I'd love to play a game called I 40 Love You. It's going to be Jeremiah versus Marion in a fan versus favorite tennis match trivia showdown all about Marion's career and life. Jeremiah, I'm going to ask you two questions about Marion's career. And then Marion, I'm going to ask you two questions that test your own memory about the life and times of Marion Bartoli Boumediene. If we happen to end up in a 2-2 tie today, I'm just going to let baby Camellia decide who she thinks the winner is today.
Oh my God.
I'm excited to jump right into the amazing career of Marion Bartoli. But to do that, we have to start at the very beginning. So question one is for our Grand Slam champion, Marion. This first question's for you. I want to test how far back your memory goes. We all know you're a smarty pants, but I wonder if you're a memory pants too. This question is all about your fantastic junior career and that amazing run to your 2001 US Open junior title. So here's your first question. Marion, on your way to that junior US Open title, you defeated a player that has started her current 2021 season with a bang by making the finals of a lead-up event in Melbourne before defeating defending champion Sofia Kenin in the second round of this year's Australian Open. Which player did you defeat that's also having a great start to her season on the way to that 2001 US Open junior title?
Kaia Kanepi.
Wow, that was
from Estonia.
I mean, this is too easy for Marion Bartoli today. She's just like, you suck at this. Give me something harder. Oh, how fun. I mean, Marion, that was 20 years ago.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, but I still can remember my whole draw. So it's just...
Okay, good to know. I think you're in trouble today, Jeremiah. I mean, you have Kaia and Svetlana and Venus and Serena, Kim, all still playing today. We're so lucky as tennis fans, aren't we? I mean, this is so great. This generation, with all the wear and tear tennis is on your body, this is so fantastic. Marion, for those that don't know your tennis journey, can you share how you first discovered tennis?
So my father and my brother were playing tennis quite regularly, I would say 5 times a week. And when I was 2.5, 3 years old, my mom was just taking me to the court and I was playing with my toys, just, you know, laying down the corner and just playing basically with my toys. But I was watching my dad and my brother playing with each other. And I did that for like 2 years. And when I was 5.5, I stood up in the middle of the court and I say, well, now I want to try. I've enough just watching you. And obviously, my dad didn't have any like small rackets because my brother is almost 9 years older than me. Mm. My brother gave me his racket, and I started to play. And apparently, I don't remember it. My dad told me that the first time I ever played tennis, I hit the ball 50 times over the net without missing on my backhand side.
Oh, well, that's good confidence to start. I mean, come on, that's that's a great way
yeah,
to start.
Yeah, so then it was like, okay, maybe she has something, maybe she can play with us. And then I played my first tournament 6 months later in my village. It was a very small tournament with only four players. And obviously, I was the youngest, and I won it, and I still have the trophy. And actually, that trophy is next to my Wimbledon trophy. And yeah, I was 6 years and 4 months old.
So obviously, to know how your story plays out at Wimbledon, it's important to know the very beginning of your story. Your father was a successful heart surgeon. At what point did you both decide that you really could make a successful career out of playing professional tennis? You said at six, you're playing your first tournaments. At what point did you say, okay, this is it, we can do this?
Well, when I was 15, I won the French championship under 16 and then the adult one, so the all-over one. And that was very, very rare because only one player in the 1980s I've been able to do so. So I won it in 2000. So then my dad said, well, look, you know, you have to try to go into the juniors. And if you're able to do something great in the juniors as well, we have to find out a way to give it a full try. And because I got my baccalaureate 2 years in advance, so basically finishing high school before getting into university, I was able to sort of having 2 free years to try out on the main circuit. But then the finance was the main problem because my father had only sort of 2 to maximum 3 years of resources, financial resources to pay for all the expensive, you know, tennis is an expensive sport. And I had to make it to the pros and to the top 100 in order to basically earn my life and financially be able to be independent. And I did it in like just before 2 years, in a year and something.
You did it very quickly. Yes, we're going to talk about it in a moment when we move on to question two. But I do want to point out, because at 8 years old, I love reading this story. You made a wish list and you gave it to your parents. And at the top of that wish list, Marianne, was a Wimbledon title at 8 years old. I mean, how amazing.
Yeah.
That story gives me chills. Obviously, your father is a brilliant surgeon. And there was, we mentioned, there was so much apprehension from the tennis world early on because he was self-taught and not the more traditional type coach. But as we know, he would ultimately get the last laugh to anyone that ever questioned his coaching at Wimbledon. Was it easy for you to separate father and coach when you were young? You obviously had to trust his vision so much when you were young.
Yeah, exactly. No, I was trusting my father, eyes closed, but it was not easy to separate both just because we were doing everything together, you know, and I was following him on his medical things. And, you know, he thought it was good for me to see everything because I would have grown and matured earlier and just learning about how life, how difficult life can be. So I was following him everywhere. And then, of course, he was driving me to all the tennis tournaments around France and driving so many kilometers to get me to the courts and play my match and then driving back to home and then having to go to school the next day. I mean, it was just a 24/7 role, basically, with me, whether it was tennis coach, father, friend, you know, someone I was crying on the shoulder. And it was just, you know, everything. So even though right now I'm 36 years old and I still call my dad every single day, it's just a connection we have that is just so strong that I trust him and I trust his advice, and even life advice right now that he's giving me.
Well, it worked out for you. Can we talk about your playing style for a minute? I had so many questions from your fans from all over the world about the two hands, the air swings, the training that you would do. There's never been a player since Marion Bartoli or before Marion Bartoli that had such an iconic and mesmerizing on-court ritual. Everything about your game was curated. A big fan of yours, TJ Greggs Edwards in Conyers, Georgia, asks, I must know why there was no bounce on the serve.
Yeah, I know. That was weird, right? It's just that I felt, well, you know, I just felt like if I was bouncing the ball, I was losing my balance. Like the leaning forward thing was just not good for me in my momentum and in my balance, and I was already having trouble to go and get the ball high enough on my serve. So I just felt like if I was shooting still, it was just being a little bit easier for me to keep that stillness into my body. So that's why I was doing it.
Yeah, there we go, TJ. We got to talk about Monica. Obviously, your game was inspired by Monica Seles. I did wonder, looking back, your father was very famous, Marion, for creating some extremely innovative drills. I think, you know, from a fan perspective, it was just so interesting to watch. Looking back, since you're a coach now yourself, what was the most creative or maybe the most unconventional drill that he had you try?
Oh my gosh, so many. But the one that was the most unconventional was, you know, again, that comes back to the serve. That was always my main problem. And to help me to go up, hitting the serve high enough, he glued two sort of small chocolate cane together. And they were so tiny. And I had to step on them and hit my serve. And literally, if I was losing the balance, I could have rolled my ankle at any minute. And it's like, you know, if it's like if I take the meal powder box of my daughter now and stick them together and having to serve on it, you know, looking back, it looks completely crazy. But actually, it helped me so much on my serve. And the year after, I was finishing number one in terms of the aces, and I served 470 aces that year, which was an incredible number for me.
Exactly. The drills work. That's the point, you know? You start playing tennis full-time. You'd become one of the best juniors in the world. Win that US Open junior title, beating Kuznetsova, and you'd had some great matches with Sveta in your career as well. In 2002, yeah, you'd spend the year playing ITF events, winning a few of them, and then it was time to play the US Open again. And this would be the first time I'd ever hear your name, Marion Bartoli. You'd qualify, winning three matches, the draw comes out, and you have to play Hall of Famer Arantxa Sánchez Vicario in the first round. What do you remember from that first US Open, Marion? Did you feel as confident as you looked in that match?
I remember so many things. So I remember actually coming by the tube to the court, just because sometimes the bus was taking too long. And in order for me to do all my routines and getting enough practice before my match, we were taking the tube in the morning.
You took the subway in New York City to the tennis center? Wow, there we go.
Yeah. And I was on the court at like sunrise, so seven something. I was eating for 2 hours and then I was getting some rest. And I played late that day. I think I played last match. So I had to wait the whole day, then re-warm up and play against Arantxa. I didn't start really well. And then I got on a roll and I think I won 6-3, 6-2, if I remember well the score.
Oh.
So that was you know, for me to beat her, who are multiple Grand Slam champion, and I've been growing up, seeing her playing against Monica was quite extraordinary.
You'd make the third round of that US Open and you'd play
another
legend, Lindsay Davenport.
And yeah.
Many fans have asked me, you know, obviously that was a great first match for you, but playing her in 2008, where you defeated her, did you get a sense that that was probably going to be the last match of her career, because you played the very last singles match of Lindsay Davenport's career?
I know, but not at all. You know, I have actually amazing memory because I play against Lindsay on Ash night session. And, you know, the night session on Arch are so special. So for me to play against her and having this sort of electric atmosphere and, you know, obviously the crowd supporting her, which is normal, but just feeling just the crowd behind and the electricity of New York at night was just incredible. But I didn't know at all that was what I would have been in the last match.
Those early years, 2002, 2003, you were such a good junior and then you transitioned to the tour. Were those tough years for you trying to get to, you said you had to get into the top 100 to kind of make a living. Was it pressure filled for you in the very beginning of your career?
Yeah, it was a lot of pressure. It was all pressure because all of the girls I played against in the juniors, Zveta, Viras, Manarera, actually Miriam Casanova as well, who you mentioned I played doubles with, Gisela Durko, all those players were making it to the top 30 very quickly, at top 30 WTA. And that was sort of at the back of the pack, and which was not normal for me because I was finishing number two in the juniors. So I really put a lot of pressure on myself. I got even the sense that I should quit, that I would not have been off level to make it to the pros. It was just so hard. And actually, the whole thing just changed when I made the third round of the US Open, because I jumped right away into close to being top 100. Then I won a big ITF in France at the end of that year, and I made it to the top 100. And after that, I just never looked back. But those first 8 months until I got to the third round of the main draw of the US Open in 2002 were really difficult for me, actually.
Well, it would get a lot easier. So we just spoke about your first ITF title. Let's go on to question two. Jeremiah, this is your first question. I'm going to test your WTA knowledge at this point. Marion started her 2006 season with her first ever WTA title in Auckland, New Zealand, to join the likes of Lindsay Davenport, Venus Williams, and Anna Ivanovic as previous champions of the event. But Jeremiah, can you recall which Grand Slam champion that Marion has a career win over was the last player to win the title in Auckland back in 2020?
Serena.
Yay, Serena. Yes, Serena Williams. I mean, Marion, Serena, you know, you've had such a special relationship with her over the years. And I know she's been a big fan of your jewelry line as well. And she's worn many pieces of yours as well. So I love that she's a friend and a competitor. I think that's so great. We'll talk about your epic Wimbledon match in a minute, but would you say your 2011 fourth round win against Serena was one of the best matches you've ever played in your career?
Oh yeah, hands down. Absolutely. And I still laugh about it with her now when I see her around in the court. You know, I'm doing her on-court interview in Roland Garros. It's so funny because I used to play against her and now I interviewed her. But I just say to her, can you imagine I play probably the best match of my life and I still was so close to not win it, because if she would have taken me to a third set, probably she would have won it. And it was just, you know, so close that actually I could have lost playing my best, and you are not at your best. Can you imagine how much margin you had over everyone else, you know, and she's still laughing about it. But that was an incredible match. I served so well that day. Oh my gosh. I think I served like 15 or 17 aces.
I mean, what that match, anyone go back and YouTube that match. That match is incredible. I wanted to highlight your 2006 season because it was really amazing. You'd win your first ever WTA tournament, as we just mentioned, in Auckland. And then you'd win the last tournament of the year as well in Quebec City. And there was a third event in Japan you'd also win for three titles that year. What did it feel like beating Zvonareva in that final to win your first title? I know you played Vera 11 times in your career, and it was a very tough opponent for you.
Yeah, Vera was a very tough opponent. We always had tough matches against each other. And, you know, we were knowing each other since the juniors as well. So it was just a follow-up and of our career, you know, basically. So you always had this sort of junior rivalry coming back into the court, even though it was a WTA event. But, you know, it was just great for me because the draw was so strong. I had to beat Nadia Petrova in the semifinal, of course, a top 10 in the world, and having so much success as well. And then Vera in the final. And I played such a good match that day that, you know, for me to win your first title is always special. But to win it against someone that you have battled, you know, against in the juniors, and then you find her in the final on your route to win your first title was just made it extra special.
Well, your other two finals that year, you'd beat Olga Puchkova. So sorry, Olga. Six love in the Quebec City final. That was the first time since 1993 anyone had ever won a WTA final by that scoreline, which was insane. But even more interesting, Marion, at the Japan Open, you beat a player named Aiko Nakamura. And it was the first time ever in WTA history that two players had played with two hands off both sides WTA final. Yeah. In 2006, you'd finish in the top 20, Marion. But by 2007, you'd enter the top 10 for the first time with a masterful run to the 2007 Wimbledon final. Let's go back to 2007 quickly, Marion. And you'd have some great wins during the grass court season against Kerber and Hantukova and Dementieva. Now it's time for Wimbledon, and you're in great form. You fight your way all the way to your first Grand Slam semifinal. And who awaits you? Justine Enna, the number one player in the world, whom at that point you'd never even taken a set off of. So it was going to be a tough match. You just played her the week before in Eastbourne and the match didn't go your way. What was it besides Piers Brosnan in the Royal Box that really turned that match around for you?
Well, to be honest, that was really the key, because I was, funny enough, my actual husband watched that match and of course was cheering for Justine back then in 2007, not knowing that 14 years later I would be his wife.
I love that he admitted that to you, by the way. That takes a real man to admit that to his wife, by the way.
Yeah, and he just said, oh my gosh, I can't believe you beat Justine, because, you know, of course my husband is Belgium and Justine and Kim in Belgium are just like goddess, which is normal with everything they've been able to win. So it was just so funny. But, you know, during that match, it was my first time on center court of Wimbledon, obviously, first time in the semifinal for Grand Slam. It was just so many firsts. And I was so intimidating to play against Justine, who beat me really badly a week and a half before in Eastbourne. And I'm on the center court of Wimbledon for the first time. And the first set, it was just awful. I wish I could find the smallest hole in the entire center court and just hide myself. it was terrible. And then I'm seeing Pierce obviously coming and sitting down in the front row of the Royal Box after the first semifinal hand up. We just probably had a small refreshment and just came back. And I was like, okay, now I have to play tennis because you could play that bad in front of him. There is no chance. What's going to think about you? And, you know, being obviously the biggest James Bond fan ever. So I just started to pick up myself, and all of a sudden it just helped me to forget all the external stress that I was going through and just refocus into something a lot lighter. And it just helped me, you know, and obviously then I was able to pick up back my momentum that I was having since the beginning of the tournament. And then I started to play better. But that really got me back on track. And that is true. It's a true story. And it's exactly what I felt. And it was just an incredible moment, you know, for me to beat Justine, number one in the world, is the only match I think she lost for the entire year. She won everything, the US Open, the Masters, everything. And to be able to do it in that fashion on the center court from in the semifinal stage, it was incredible.
Obviously, you've played so many matches in your career. Was that was it overwhelming? You said it was like trying to find a pocket on the court, but was it the most nervous you think you'd ever been, or do you think you were more nervous playing maybe in your Wimbledon final in 13?
Oh, no. By far, the first set against Justine was the most nervous I ever felt in tennis court. Oh. It was just awful. Oh, my gosh. I couldn't swing the ball. It was terrible.
I mean, I love that you wake up and you get to play in the Wimbledon final in 2007, though. It's just so incredible. Yeah. I mean, after everything, especially someone like Venus, you get to play. So quite a fairy tale moment for you, Marion. But your moment would soon come. So let's go to question 3 of 4, and it's about some of your great milestones from throughout your career, Marion. So here is your last question. Let's go back almost 10 years to 2012, the Miami Open quarterfinals, where Marion Bartoli would play lights out as she defeated world number one Vika Azarenka, who was flying high on a 26-match win streak to start her year. I tested your memory earlier with player names, Marion, and you aced it. I thought I'd test your memory with numbers now. So here's your question. Okay. Can you remember the scoreline from that quarterfinal match in Miami against Vika?
I would say 6-3, 6-3.
You're a genius, Marion Bartoli. I don't know. I heard rumors about your IQ, but it is 100%. I mean,
no, because you know why I remember it is because I won the first set 6-3. And then she's leading 3-1 in the second, and things start to get pretty tight. And then I was able to get back and crawl back my way. And 3-all, I broke her to lead 4-3. Sorry. And then I really felt that I had the match finally in my hand, which was something so difficult to get over Vika because, you know, she's playing so well that she put so much pressure on yourself. So that's why I remember the scoreline, because I just had that moment during the match when I felt, when I was set in 4-3, that finally was sort of mine.
It was your third victory against a world number one. There was so much hype around Vika's win streak, and she was playing such amazing tennis at that time. So amazing. What do you remember with some of your battles with Vika? You played each other 12 times in your career. What a tough competitor for both of you.
Yeah, she was incredible. But I remember her intensity on the court. And actually, I think the first time I played against her was in Australia. I think she was only 16 years old. At the Australian Open, and I just see that girl, and she reminded me so much of Maria Sharapova in the way when she was younger as well, and I remember telling myself this girl is going to be number one in the world. There was just no doubt. It was just so much fire through her eyes, and you know, this mental attitude to feel confident about herself, but not in an arrogant way. She never felt arrogant, but she put so much work and intensity in what she was doing, and you know, she sincerely and truly deserves everything she has been able to do on the court. And I'm so happy to see her back now. Last year playing so well. And I hope she can win a Grand Slam title again. I think it would be an incredible story.
I hope so too. Marion, after your Wimbledon final in 2007, the next few years, you'd have some great career milestones. In 2009, you'd make your first Australian Open quarterfinal by upsetting then world number one, Jelena Jankovic, in the fourth round. Including Justine and Vika, that would have been the third time in your career that you defeated a reigning world number one. It was also Jeremiah's very favorite moment of yours. Jeremiah, why did you love that moment so much? What was it about that match in particular?
I just think the dynamic between Jankovic and Marion was very interesting. And Jelena was number one in the world. And Marion just came out and just blitzed her. Like first set, I think it was 6-love. And the second set started to get a little bit close, but Marion was just coming up with these crazy shots. And I was watching it with a group of people. I think I was actually in LA the time that we met. And we were just all cheering Marion. It was just like, just her execution, like, it was so fun.
It was so funny. Marion, I had so many questions from your Australian fans. They ask, Marion, what was your favorite thing about going to Melbourne? And what do you consider your favorite match memory in Australia?
My favorite thing was, to see all the fans from each country coming and cheering on for their players. I think that was so cool to see, the Swedish fans and then the Croatian fans and the Bulgarian fans and obviously the French fans. It's just so nice to see so many different communities gathering together to come and cheer on for their players. And I love to see the colors in the stands. You know, they were all coming with the flag colors, wearing the flag colors. It was just so cool. And obviously this match against Yelena and the one in the previous round against Lucy was two of my favorite moments just because I played so well. It was brutally hot that year. It was like 42 plus. It was a torture, honestly, to be on the court. And just to be able to still come up as a winner and put the effort on the court, I was pretty proud of myself.
That same year, you'd make the quarters of Australia in 2009. You'd win one of the biggest titles of your career when you played Venus again for the first time since your Wimbledon final. And it was another big final at the Bank of the West Classic in Stanford. I remember being glued to my TV for that match. Was that title a big confidence builder for you, Marion? I know you just played her in Wimbledon and that was a big moment for you too. But how important was that title for you?
It was huge. I mean, the draw... You know how Stanford is such a tough draw. And I had to play Yelena in the quarters, Sam Stoddard in the semis, and Venus in the final. It's all Grand Slam champions, all number one in the world. And it was just so hard. And against Venus, I was leading 6-2, 5-3 and couldn't close it out. She won the second 7-5. I was leading in the third and things start to get close again. And just finally to win that match, 6-4 in the third. And, just beating Venus. I mean, honestly, I grew up just watching Venus all the time and of course Serena and winning so many things and winning titles and winning Grand Slams. And for me, being coached by my father and being able to come up with such a small village in the middle of nowhere in France and being able to beat those kind of icon of the game, which is such an incredible and proud moment for my father as well. I remember just watching him, he was just so proud.
Aww.
It was nice.
Did you feel playing that Stanford final, did you feel like you had to have some redemption because of Wimbledon? Was that a factor in your head when you play somebody that you lose to and then you play them again? As a professional athlete, is that something you thought about?
Sort of. I remember just saying myself, because Venus just crushed Elena Dementieva in the semis. I think she won 6-love, 6-1 or 6-1, 6-love or something. And then the quarter, she beat Maria. And I just remember telling myself, my God, I mean, honestly, if I don't serve well, I have zero chance because she was just crushing every single returns and you know how hard it is to break Venus when she serves well. So I just remember saying to myself, you have to find a way to hold your serve. You have to find a way to hold your serve and return Venus serve, put it into the court somehow and get the rally going. And all of a sudden I start actually to play much better than what I thought. I start to lead and then, you realize actually you can win this and you can win the tournament and it's such a big tournament. So it was just mentally tough to close it out. I remember how hard it was to close it out, but it's such fun and great memories. And I remember this game. I even remember which outfit Venus was wearing that day.
I mean, I love that you had this photographic memory. You're remembering scores of not even your own matches. So this is what a great coach you're going to be. I mean, obviously, Yelena's very lucky because, you have this photographic memory. We chatted about Venus and Vika and Aga. We've mentioned Serena and Yelena now, but one of your biggest fans, Marion, Julie Andre in Lyon, France, asks, who do you personally consider your biggest rival throughout your career?
Biggest rival throughout my career? Well, it's hard because, I played some players at different stage of tournaments. And obviously, even though all matches are important, but some are even more important than others. I would say, obviously, Venus, because she beat me in the final of Wimbledon, is such an important moment. If you can win another Grand Slam title, that's something completely different. And Maria as well, because, she beat me into some tough matches. That quarterfinal of the US Open in 2012, I was also playing so well. I just beat Petra Kvitova the match before. I played incredible night match on Grandstand, which was such a great memory. And I played Maria on Ash over 2 days. I lost a very tough one, 6-4 in the third. So I can't really identify one. It was just a group of players that were all so strong, and you had to sneak in and find a way to win one Grand Slam or two if you can. And I'm just so proud I've been able to play with those girls over those years, because I felt that was the strongest moment of women's tennis, and be able to have all those memories is something, it's for me, that is very important.
I want to wrap up today by talking about two last tournaments. One was truly an amazing accomplishment for you. In 2011, you'd make the French Open semifinals. And we talked a little bit at the top of the show about such great Grand Slam champions you've had in France with Mary Pierce and Amélie Mauresmo after they retired.
Yeah.
Did you feel during that Paris run in 2011 that you were getting genuine support in Paris? Was it a, I just wonder, as an American fan looking back, I remember thinking how protective we felt of you, because we didn't feel you were getting all that you truly deserved. Did you feel that way in that run?
Well, 2011 was such a cool moment, because I really felt I had the whole France behind me. I mean, I was going out of the hotel, just getting like a newspaper or something in the local newspaper shop. And then everyone was recognizing me and cheering me on and wishing me luck. And, you know, it was such a cool moment. And I remember even after the semifinal when I lost it and we went back to Switzerland driving with my parents. And we stop at the petrol station, and everyone at the petrol station recognized me and just trying to say, we're so proud of you. And we watched every single of your match, and you were so close and you made us proud. I mean, none of players have been able to reach the semifinal or better at Roland Garros. Only Mary Pierce and I believe myself, even Amélie, stopped at the quarterfinal, and she was an amazing champion. It's not easy to play in France. You know, you just feel you want to do so well and you put so much pressure on yourself. And especially for me, clay court was by far my worst surface. So I had to battle so many things. But that year was just so much fun. You know, I played Zveta in the quarters.
The best play match of your career, for sure. I mean, beating Svetlana Kuznetsova in the quarterfinal, a French Open champion. I mean, absolutely remarkable. Really great job.
Yeah, it was really cool. And I had the whole stadium on their feet afterwards, just screaming my name. It was just really nice memories.
Oh, what a good memory. I mean, that's a good memory to wake up to. That's a good memory to dream about when someone's chanting your name. You'd win 8 titles in your career, Marion, including another big grass court title in Eastbourne against Petra Kvitova, who I think you were the only one that beat her on grass that year too, by the way. That was a very special year. If you had to pick one of the 8 titles besides Wimbledon, is there one that maybe means a little bit more to you than the others?
I would go with Stanford, just because I had to beat so many amazing players, and to beat Venus in the final was just a cherry on the cake. It was just an incredible moment.
Well, with all those great title runs, by 2012, your hard work would pay off. You'd reach your career high ranking of 7 in the world. But just when you thought things were going in the right direction, 2013 would come along and completely change your career forever. So let's go to our very last question today about your 2013 Wimbledon title. And this is for you, Jeremiah. Here's your final question. It's about Wimbledon tradition. There is a storied Wimbledon tradition that the defending ladies champion plays the first match on center court to open day 2. In 2014, the event had no defending champion, as Marion had retired by that point. So I wondered if you remember which European Wimbledon fan favorite that went on to reach the quarterfinals in 2014 they gave the honor to instead, Jeremiah.
I have it. I know it.
I mean, this. Oh, I love, she's showing you up today. I mean, Jeremiah, you can still tie today with this. You can do it. Who do we think? Let's think about it.
It'd be an honor to lose to Marion, but I mean, I guess it would be a British player, Konta.
Okay. Hey, that's a great guess. You know, I love it. I mean, come on. I mean, that's a good guess today. Marion, who opened on your behalf for on day 2 of 2014?
Of course, Sabine Lisicki. Yes.
Sabine Lisicki, it was. Oh my gosh. Marion, was watching 2014 freeing for you in a sense? Obviously, you didn't have to go through the anxiety of playing. Was that difficult for you that you weren't playing, or was it easier for you that you weren't playing?
Oh my gosh, it was heartbreaking.
Okay.
Are you kidding? It was so hard. It was just, I was pretending to smile on the outside, but I was dying. It was terrible. But I had no other choice. My shoulder was just completely broke. I couldn't serve anymore. After 45 minutes, my whole body was just down. I had so much inflammation everywhere, tendonitis, on my Achilles tendonitis, on my hip joint, my shoulder. It was just my whole body was breaking down piece after piece. And I just, you know, my whole life I've been striving to be the best and obviously competing with the best and being in the top 10 and reaching the final or going far into tournaments. I couldn't see myself just going there for the sake of going there and losing after one or two matches. It was just not me. So I had to admit it, the fact that I just couldn't do what I loved the most anymore. But it was a hard transition. It was difficult.
I want to close today with the fairy tale ending that your story deserves. In 2013, Marianne fulfilled her lifelong dream of winning Wimbledon. Let's wrap up today and talk about those amazing 2 weeks. Marianne, if you hadn't won Wimbledon that year in 2013, do you think you would have kept playing and gone back in 2014?
Not for very long. I probably would have finished the year and finished my career at the Gaz de France Open in February indoors in Paris, which was called back then Paris Indoors. That would have been probably my last tournament just to finish in France. But I don't think, you know what, entering Wimbledon in 2013, I knew it was my last shot to make my dream a reality.
So I was just going to ask, you felt that going into that Wimbledon, you felt this is all or nothing for you? This was
your last time.
Well, to know the whole story, let's go back at the start of the year. You had announced at the start of the year that you were going to work with other coaches and not just your father. And that must have been very difficult. I can't imagine. We saw Sophia Kennan recently announce that she is just promoting her father to just father instead of coach. So hopefully she reaches out to you, because I'm sure you can give her a lot of wisdom, because it worked for you. So maybe it'll work for her. But obviously, it was probably very difficult to move on to just have Papa instead of Coach Papa. Mm-hmm. But then you start working with Amélie Mauresmo, and you'd bring her into your coaching team right before Wimbledon. What did Amélie bring to your team that you needed most at that time?
Well, you know, the key, and I would say to Sophia if she asked me, but the key is to surround yourself with great people with amazing knowledge. Because what happens when you're quitting something that you know so much for so many years is you feel hopeless. You feel like you don't know what to do. You're ending up on your own, and you have to find, you know, your training routine yourself, or you have to pick up your team, and you don't know if it's going to work, if it's not going to work. So you have to really pick up people that you can trust and have an incredible level of knowledge in order for you to give your trust as well to those people. And that is the most difficult part. And you know, in Wimbledon 2013, I just felt I had the exact right team with the exact number of people I needed at that time. I needed a full-time physio. He was a Fed Cup physio. I knew him. I knew the way he worked. Incredible to work on my body because I was suffering so much with so many pains everywhere. I had a great physical coach who understand what I needed at that moment to level up my fitness level and made me strong enough to win on grass. Amélie obviously gave me the confidence and, you know, just put me in the right mental set to be able to go and play those difficult matches with so much pressure on. And I didn't feel for a minute that I was stressed. I was just going on the court being extremely focused, but not stressed. And that is a huge difference.
Huge.
And I had a great hitting partner in Thomas Drouet, who is now becoming a coach. But back then, he was my hitting partner. And we're just playing well. And so when I was on the court, I knew exactly what kind of training I was doing for exactly how many minutes. He knew the drills. I didn't have to talk much. He knew exactly what I was expecting for him. And just everything started to click, you know. And when everyone is playing their roles and they do it well, and you feel like you're going with the whole team with you on the court, you're not alone anymore. And that was very special.
I love hearing that. You started your grass court season that year in Eastbourne, and you had to retire in your second match against Lina. I believe you had a high fever, or there was something, if I recall, that was something big. But there's this powerful and very personal interview that you gave to CNN at the end of 2013. And I remember reading it. It was very introspective, and it spoke a lot about your relationship with your mother and your brother and your father, and which you elaborated beautifully in your book, by the way. So again, make sure you everyone go out and read that book. But there's a quote in there that I read that I've always wondered about, and to this day. And you say in the quote, "If I tell you what was happening 3 days in my life before Wimbledon started, you'll never believe that I won." So I've always wondered, what was the lead up to that Wimbledon like for you? What was going on in your world that this was just the fairy tale ending for you that you had ever hoped?
Yeah, it was difficult because basically 3 days before Wimbledon start, I didn't have any team. You know, it was just Thomas were there as a hitting partner in Eastbourne with me. I pulled out of the second round of Eastbourne after beating Flavia in the first round. I pulled out against Lina because I had like 40 degrees fever. My whole body was so tired. I was catching up every single virus that was going on. You know, my immune system was completely down. So I felt I went there without any friends at all. And I had to, you know, play my best tennis and win Wimbledon. But day by day, you know, I called the French Federation. I talked to, back then the president was Jean Gachassin. I told him, well, look, you really have to help me because I'm such in a deep hole, but I feel I still have it into my body. I still can do it, but I have to really have the most amazing team around me. And, you know, it was great. It just told me, okay, we're going to give you the fitness coach of the Fed Cup team and the physio of the Fed Cup team. They're going to be there for you. Obviously, they're going to be there for the rest of the French player, but because you're French number one, you will be the priority. And then you will have Amélie who supervised in a way the whole thing. And I just went like this. And basically, we all met up on the Friday before Wimbledon start. We put up a plan for the Saturday, Sunday. I start to play Monday. And here we went. 15 days later, I just won Wimbledon without dropping a set. I mean, it was just extraordinary.
You played brilliantly all through your matches and you won in straight sets. I mean, just saving enough for the final, which is so amazing. Let's talk about that final. At that time, Sabine was famous for peaking at Wimbledon and it was going to be a tough match regardless for both of you. You had played her three times at Wimbledon, which I found very interesting, by the way. That is such a weird stat that you get to play her three times at Wimbledon in your career. Yeah. Did you follow your game plan in that final or did you just kind of go with the flow and just wait for her to kind of be nervous? And because you know how it felt in 2007. So you had feeling. What was the game plan for that match?
No, I had a very clear game plan. And that was also something we talked about with Amélie before each match. You know, obviously she had the eyes of the next player. So we were talking about the tactic, what I felt I should do, what she felt I should do. And then most of the time we were agreed, but to come up with a very clear strategic plan was always easier. And I found it was always easier for me because I can always rely to that when I felt a little bit lost in the match. And obviously everything's starting to go so well. I was up 6-1, 5-1, 15-40. And then I started to tell myself, okay, now I won Wimbledon. And when I started to tell myself that my feet got completely stuck into the ground, I felt I had 3 kilos of glues under each sole and I just couldn't move anymore. And, you know, I had to regroup and I have to find a way to close it out because I'm not going to be so close from winning my title. And the DNs, they just sleep and they go. And at 5-4, when I sit down, I just had 1 minute when it was just myself alone on the court. I completely blocked out everything else, the crowd, even Sabine, the stage, whatever. I just blocked everything. And I just say, okay, this is a game plan. Remember what you have to do. Remember how you're doing it and the technique you have to use to make it. And that's why I went through that game very sort of as a robot. 1 point, 2 points, 3 points, 4 points, four first serves, the directions, taking the ball early, being inside the court. And I went through the game like this instead of just getting myself going through emotions, which were normal to feel, but I had to block them.
I love hearing that because obviously looking, the intensity you had during that final was unparalleled. It was just, I remember commentator Joe Dury saying, no one will beat her with this intensity. It was just, I mean, another level. And I love that you admit that, yeah, at the very end, it just was sinking in. I was going to win Wimbledon when I was up so much. I love there was a human side of that too, before you said, nope, I'm going to do this. I'm going to make this happen. At what point did it sink in after that ace that you hit on match point? Obviously, probably things went very quickly for you and you probably don't remember a lot that happened, but at what point do you feel like it really sunk in afterwards that you had won Wimbledon?
Oh my gosh, it took me months. I remember the first, I think, months I was sleeping with a trophy just to make sure it was mine. I was like, oh my gosh, one day I'm going to wake up and, you know, someone will tell me, no, actually you didn't win Wimbledon at all. It was just a dream. And you still have 0 Grand Slam title. So I slept with a trophy for a full month. And you know, the years I've been going by, the most I actually realized I won Wimbledon and how difficult it has been and how cool it is to be called a Wimbledon champion in singles. That's just something I'm just so proud of myself, especially in the era when Serena won 23 and you had so little openings, you know, Kim and Justine and Maria and all those players and Venus, of course, and how many chances I had. I had only 2 and I was able to grab one. And I'm just so proud of myself for that. Yeah.
Well, we're proud of you too. Did you ever go back and watch that match? How many times have you gone back to watch? When was the last time you got to watch that final?
a million times probably.
I mean, if I won Wimbledon, I would be a million and one. So yes, 100%. Oh, absolutely.
No, okay. every time I had like a down moment, or I feel tired, or you know, I feel stressed about a situation or whatever, I have the match obviously in my computer. So I just put it, and I just put the last game. I don't actually put the whole match. Oh. I just put the last game. And after that, I close my computer. I'm like, okay, if I've been able to do this, I can do whatever is in
front
of me.
Of course, if you're ever feeling down. Yeah. What's a better motivator than that, watching yourself hit an ace to win Wimbledon? I love it. Your fans, one last question about Wimbledon. Your fans ask, are there any stories about that Wimbledon 2013 that you haven't told anyone? They'd love to know anything inside. Maybe a match against an earlier round. Was there anything? Did you have the same place you stayed every year? Are you superstitious?
No, that was the first year I stayed in that place. And obviously it became very special. And every year I go back to that place and I just show my husband where I used to stay when I won Wimbledon. And I remember just having those sort of lucky socks you know, I was like obviously having so many pairs, different ones and whatever, it was different colors and stuff. But, you know, it's Wimbledon, it's all white. But that year, my clothing sponsor made me those white socks, but with a logo in different colors underneath. And the one I was wearing was the purple one. And they just gave me like two or three pairs, no more. And obviously, I always have to have one exchange pairs in my bag just in case something was happening. And I was wearing the exact same pair with the exact same colors for every single match. And I had like the person in the laundry in the members' locker room to wash it for me every single time, making sure they don't lose it or whatever. It was very, very specific. That's a pair of socks.
Did you do that otherwise in your career? Were you very superstitious at other tournaments too?
I was quite superstitious, but not that much. But I don't know why at that Wimbledon, it was that pair of socks I had to wear every single time.
It worked.
It did.
As we wrap up today, I wanted to talk about the amazing work you've done with Yelena Ostapenko. It's so fun to see, and we hope to see you back on tour coaching once your family time allows it at some point. How has coaching been for you? Are you enjoying the process?
I love the process of coaching and also the adrenaline of being on the court, obviously, when she's playing and I was able to travel with her. It was just so much fun. You know, it was just remembering when I used to play and going back to those tournaments, I used to play myself and see those people I used to know for so many years. It has been such a fun ride. And, you know, just to try to help her on a daily basis or help her with her feelings or whatever she feels, you know, I can stress her or something she doesn't feel comfortable with. Obviously, I can relate and try to help. Has been really cool. And also try to give her some changing into her game. Obviously, it takes a little bit of time before someone can put it out on the court. But we're in the process of that. And no, it's just great.
Do you see yourself working with other players maybe down the road one day as well? Maybe Benoit Paire needs a new coach. I think he probably does. Maybe we'll set that up.
Yeah. No, I love to coach. So whoever wants to get some help, and obviously the more Camilla will grow, the easier it's going to be for me to travel with her and therefore to be on the tournaments. But yeah, I absolutely see myself as a coach and a tennis commentator and then the rest of my activities. But I really hope I can keep it up with the coaching and having someone to coach every single year. Yeah.
After Wimbledon, I know you attempted the hard court season. We talked about the injuries and the body, unfortunately, just said no.
Yeah.
But looking back, would you still choose that moment in Cincinnati to have that press conference? If you think about it all these years later, was that the right time for you, or that just had to been that time? You shocked everybody. You knew that, right? It was the whole tennis world stopped that day. It was like,
yeah, I know.
You had everyone calling each other and texting and saying, what happened? What is going on right now? There's no way.
I know. I remember just laughing about it with Andy Roddy because he had a show on Fox, and one of his, you know, the person who are bringing him some of the news just tell him Marion Bartoli just retired in Cincinnati. And he was like, yeah, she retired from the match. He was like, no, she retired from her whole career. And he was like, yeah, stop it. I mean, if she's retired from her whole career, I will shave my entire eyebrows. And I played the year later. I played with him on the World Team Tennis, and he was like laughing about it. He was like, you made me shave my whole entire eyebrows because you decided to retire 3 weeks after you won Wimbledon. And I was like, yeah, I wish I could have continued playing, to be honest with you. But I don't think there is a right moment because, you know, it's like a small death that you have to recover from, stopping from being a professional athlete. But it was inevitable. I just couldn't play tennis anymore, simply.
Well, one thing I do really love, Marion, is your commentating. I think you are so great at what you do. Your on-court analysis and your interviews are always so entertaining. We've talked about your career being in two phases. your 15 to 30 year old phase, and now you're in this next phase and being a new mom, WTA super coach, commentator, and most of all, very happy. You know, you seem very happy. So that's really great. My last question today, Marianne, looking back, if you're able to change one thing about your career, is there anything you change or maybe do differently?
Yeah, I would have hired a private physio a lot earlier on. And I think that would have helped me to just clinch one or two extra years into my career. But, you know, back then, the revenue and the price money were not as high as it is now. And it was very costly to get a private physio. And it was just hard to travel with someone as well all the time. But yeah, if I could have changed something, that would have been that.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you so much. Congrats. You were the winner of Fan versus Favorite today. So Marianne beats Jeremiah. It was inevitable, Jeremiah. Her memory is like...
You didn't even ask me about her career. I was ready for her career.
Always end the show with a question from one of your biggest fans. And today we have Jeremiah. So the last question is yours, Jeremiah. Any question for Marianne?
Oh, wow. So to piggyback off of you, I mean, you asked pretty much everything I wanted to ask. But kind of going back to coaching, Marianne, you also worked a little bit with Jana Novotná. And I'm just curious, like, did any anecdotes you have about Jana? She obviously passed away a few years back and, you know, she also won Wimbledon.
Yep.
Was that pivotal for you winning Wimbledon as well, also having Amelie? And then in addition to that, do you feel pressure as a coach to have your athlete win a Grand Slam?
Well, that's a lot of questions in one. To come back to Jana, obviously, I was so sad when she passed away. It was just such a sad moment. It was very interesting the time I spent on the court with her because obviously she had a vision of the game. But the problem is the way she was playing was so different from mine that it was hard for her to understand in a way my game. But she gave me a lot of advice in regards of the mental aspect and everything you have to do to win a Grand Slam and especially to come back after losing Grand Slam final, which happens to her as well when she was in tears. Obviously, we all remember that image at Wimbledon. So she really teach me a lot of things outside of the court. And for Amelie, which is the same, just to talk with someone who have been able to do it, to win a Grand Slam, to lead those kind of trophy, who have had doubts in the past, just like I was having doubts as well, and they were able to overpass them, just gave me such a strong boost mentally. You know, I felt like I could talk to some people who went through the same thing as me and find advice and find comfort. And that was great. You know, that was great for me in my career. And then for the pressure of winning a Grand Slam, you know, it just, for me, obviously the one who has the most pressure is the athletes and the player, but not all the players want to win a Grand Slam. And this is where sometimes I'm struggling with some players because they have low expectation about themselves. But, you know, to work with someone who has a high expectation, I think it's amazing for a coach because you can really, you know, bring everything you think is important on the table and then work with your athletes towards the same goal. And that is an extraordinary journey.
What a ridiculously fun hour. Holy moly, that was Marianne Bartoli, everybody. I want to thank my guests for joining us today. We learned so much. You can find Jeremiah on Instagram at iron_knee35. Thank you, my friend. It was so great to chat with you today and be a part of this. This is magic. Our incredible champion can be found on Instagram at BartoliMarianne or Twitter at Bartoli_Marianne. I seriously cannot thank you enough, Marianne, on behalf of all your fans.
No worries, my pleasure.
We wish you so much love.
Thank you so much, guys.
I can't wait to see all the things that you have coming out. We'll definitely be supporting, and you're part of the fantastic family now. So really, really thank you. And while you're on Instagram, shoot me a DM at John Garica and let me know who you're a big fan of and who you'd like to see on an upcoming show. Also, don't forget to follow us at Fantastic Tennis Pod or on Twitter at FanTennisPod. My name is John Garica, and thank you for listening. This has been fantastic.